Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm discussing with my colleague Simone Tagliapietra, senior fellow at Bruegel. We have just together with two further colleagues, Niklas Poitier and Georg Zachmann, published a piece in Foreign Affairs on sanctions and in particular on how Europe can withstand counter sanctions and stay united in the face of counter sanctions and keep up and face the pressure that would come out of counter sanctions that Russia would impose on Europe. But to perhaps introduce the topic and to set the frame right, so the European Union, as well as United Kingdom, the US and other major Western powers, have decided on major financial and economic sanctions against Russia. They've decided to cut many banks out of the SWIFT system. They've decided to freeze Russian central bank assets and do not allow transactions with these central bank assets. Meanwhile, gas is still flowing from Russia, and the fear that is now gripping Europeans and many European countries is that this gas flow might stop, and as it stops, shortages will arise, and those shortages will lead to disunity. There's also fear about other counter sanctions that could be done, such as freezing of assets, stopping exports, imports, and other economic activities that, of course, are also interlinked with the payment system. So as SWIFT is getting interrupted, it becomes also more difficult to actually pay for economic transactions, and so therefore also trade flows between Russia and the European economy could get severely interrupted in the wake of this crisis. So our foreign affairs piece really tries to really develop the strategy of how to deal with the counter sanctions. And this is what we want to discuss today. And so let me give the floor now to Simone to perhaps give us a few further elements from our article. And then we will ping pong back and forth among the two of us for no more than, I would say, 25 minutes to just get you, our listeners, a view and an overview of what we are describing in this FA article. Simone, over to you.
Thank you, Guntram. And indeed, what we have done with this article is to try to focus on what kind of strategy Europe needs in order to maintain unity on sanctions against Russia in the longer term. The idea here is that to be really effective, sanctions might have to last a long time, and ensuring European countries backing these sanctions for a long time is crucial to make them work. And in our view, the starting point, the necessary starting point here, needs to be the one of understanding where Russia pressure points on Europe are. We know that different European countries are differently exposed to Russia. Mapping out this fragmented situation is very important to understand where these pressure points are. And that's exactly our starting point in the analysis. And if you look at this, it is clear, first of all, to start with gas, which is the main item probably here. We know that overall Europe is 40% dependent on Russian gas overall, but there are countries that are way more exposed than others. So we have, of course, Germany, more than 50% of the gas consumed in the country comes from Russia. It is even more in countries like Austria, more than 60%, not to talk about Poland, 80%, or Bulgaria and other Eastern countries that are really almost fully dependent on Russia. But then you have countries like Spain, Portugal, that do not really import anything from Russia, not a single molecule. Then, of course, the other big item is the economic and financial exposure. And then we have really digged into the trade numbers. And these trade numbers show that Europe has a significant advantage in its economic relationship with Russia. Because while Russia relies on the European market for more than half of its exports, European Union sends only 5% of its exports to Russia in turn. So our exposure in terms of trade to Russia is indeed pretty limited. And as a matter of fact, no EU country sends more than 20% of its exports to Russia. So building on this mapping, which of course also included financial, and we know that there are certain banks spanning from UniCredit to Societe Generale and others that are particularly exposed to Russia, we have come up with an idea that for the EU to sustain bold and far-reaching sanctions in the long run, well, Europe needs to set up a sort of compensation scheme. What is needed here is to set up a fund that could be in the order of magnitude of 20 billions per year, financed by EU borrowing, to basically support those sectors and companies across Europe that are particularly exposed to the sanctions vis-a-vis Russia. This could be an instrument of solidarity that can really ensure European unity over time, solidarity, and also therefore our political unity and relevance.
Right. So let's talk a bit about the response. I think you've mapped very nicely the exposures and also shown that very different countries have different degrees of exposure to the Russian economy, both on the trade side as well as on the gas import side. A lot of talk was already about Italian handbags and the fear that these Italian handbags cannot be sold to Russia. Now, this might sound ridiculous, but of course, there are very specific interests behind it and very specific companies, but also workers that would be affected by sanctions. And of course, on the bigger picture, some countries such as Bulgaria importing 100% of gas from Russia may be very directly and very strongly affected by a possible export ban that Vladimir Putin might decide on. So I think our strategy really has these two major legs. I mean, the first big leg is about ensuring physical solidarity, so to speak, meaning the ones that have gas need to be ready to share that gas with the ones that do not have gas. And that requires political will, because if you sit on full gas capacity reserves and the winter is coming, it is really quite an exercise of solidarity to reduce your own consumption so that others can keep their consumption up and don't have to reduce it to 0%. So this is, I think, the first really important act of solidarity. And we are showing, for example, that the Netherlands and France and others, they will have more gas available than some Eastern European countries. And so an important part of the solidarity that will be needed to sustain the unity will be about shipping gas from Western countries to Eastern countries and finding the infrastructure for doing this. So this is one dimension. And the other is the more financial solidarity dimension. You mentioned it already briefly, Simona. Of course, what we are proposing here is that there are, in fact, significant losses. They are not macroeconomically so big, but they are very targeted in specific sectors and very important in specific industries or for households. And so there, our idea was, well, if Europe wants to be a geopolitical actor, it has to also have the financial instruments, domestic financial instruments, to deal with that, meaning a borrowing facility to support those most affected by counter sanctions would really be quite cohesive and bring together the European countries. So Simona, let me push you a little bit more on the gas side of the story and really how you see the next winter could look like if there is no gas inflows anymore. You're also publishing another blog post today where you did the simulations and run the numbers. And it does show that we will actually see quite some shortages. So to what extent can that be compensated? And what kind of taboos do we need to break, including keeping on coal-fired power plants or restarting even some nuclear energy power plants?
Yes, the situation will, of course, not be easy to manage. It will be also very difficult, by the way, to plan properly such a replacement of the huge volumes that Russia sends to Europe every year. We remember it's more than 1,700 terawatt hours per year that we consume of Russian gas. And here, what we see is, on the one hand, the need to do whatever we can to secure additional LNG supplies. And we know that the problem globally is on the production side. The LNG market globally is very tight, working at full capacity almost. The liquefaction capacity is almost fully utilized globally. So we understand the value of the diplomatic push made by the European Commission, but also by the US administration to countries like Qatar and other producers to try to make whatever possible to send additional volumes to Europe, but also countries that are consuming LNG in Asia, such as Japan, South Korea, to ask them to divert cargoes to Europe in case of an interruption of Russian gas, to show solidarity to Europe. So this is a first important component. The other important component, in our view, is certainly the one of storage. The storage we have in Europe is very important. It allows Europe to have a buffer against these also geopolitical risks. And the problem for Europe after this winter will be to fill up the storage in the spring and in the summer to get ready for the next winter. Typically, we do that using a lot of Russian gas that comes at a very low cost in that part of the year. And usually, Europe pays around 10 billion euros to refill the storages. At current prices, we might be paying 70, 80 billion euros to fill up the storages. So this is going to be extremely expensive. And again, the problem there is that energy companies in Europe that typically have to do this operation might have difficulties in doing so because they might be afraid that further down the road, the prices might be lower and therefore they might postpone the decision. So we will need a degree of public intervention here to secure that markets deliver, to secure that gas companies actually fill up these storages. And that's exactly what we have to ensure through contracts for difference, of some instruments of that sort, because we cannot start the next winter without the storages being full. And by the way, here we also need to act on regulation. Currently, we don't mandate companies owning these facilities to fill them up. That's exactly the reason why Gazprom didn't fill up their own facilities in Europe ahead of this winter. They said, well, you don't ask us to do that. We are not obliged to do so by the regulation. And that's real. So we need to change the regulation to oblige these companies to fill up these storages and possibly create strategic storages of gas like Italy or France already have in their own respective local situation. So this is very important, but it's not sufficient. LNG storage, very important, but not sufficient. We will have to open up again the coal-fired power plants that we have been closing down over the last years. We see countries from Germany to Italy already having emergency plans to do so. So in case of an interruption of Russian gas, these countries will open up those power plants running on coal or even on oil that are currently sitting idle. And of course, a prolonged life of certain nuclear power plants, for example, in Germany, will be necessary. And we saw yesterday the finance minister starting a conversation, let's say, on the opportunity or the need to prolong the life of German nuclear power plants should such a scenario occur. This is to say that with all these options, we can mitigate the impact, but the impact will still be there. Particularly in certain countries in the East, physical disruptions might well occur. And therefore, in those situations, industrial gas demand will have to be curtailed. in order to prioritize the residential heating. So this will come at a huge economic cost also from these physical interruptions that will happen somewhere across Europe, namely in the most exposed countries to Russian gas. And this effect goes on top on the overall price effect, which will, of course, be huge. If Russia tomorrow interrupts the flows to Europe, then the gas price will go to the moon. And as a result of that, not only the gas bills of all Europeans, but also the electricity bills will be way higher than today. And therefore, that will further add, by the way, pressure on inflation as well.
Right. So we will talk in another event about the macro implications of this ongoing crisis, which is, of course, quite comparable to a negative oil price shock or stagflationary shock, having major consequences for inflation and for our economic activities, combined with the additional demand push coming from defense. But I want to spend a few last minutes on what it all means, let's say, purely on the gas revenue side for Russia itself. Obviously, Russia has now increased, actually, its exports through Ukraine of gas, thereby increasing its revenues. So one discussion is, of course, how would Russia cope, given that its assets are already freezed, or many assets are freezed? How would it cope with less cash coming in from less exports? And, you know, one dimension I find quite fascinating is that, of course, the major revenues from natural resource exports that Russia has are not coming from gas, but from oil. So oil is more important than gas for the Russian economy's revenues. And as the gas prices are increasing, so do oil prices increase. And there's some substitution since there's substitution also towards oil. And oil is basically a global market. So this is being oil is being filled on ships and then transported around the world. So I guess my question, Simone, perhaps very last question, and we did some back of the envelope calculations on it together, but perhaps you can give our listeners a sense of, you know, what's the order of magnitude here of what Russia loses if it stops exporting gas, and how much could it gain because of higher oil prices?
Yes, I think you really went to the key point here. Russia makes cash out of oil more than gas. Gas is very geopolitical because of the rigidity created by this pipeline infrastructure, right? But oil is the real cash machine of the country. And if we did indeed certain calculations, if we look at the volumes that traditionally Russia has been sending to Europe in a typical months of March and April, and we of course adjust for the lower volumes that they have been sending this year, well, Russia would miss over the next 2 months something like 20 billion euros in revenues from an eventual interruption of gas supplies to Europe. But they could easily compensate this by higher revenues on oil, because if just there is, let's say, a $20 per barrel increase in the price of oil, which is not to be dismissed in such a worst scenario, then they could already only with that increase in the oil price basically compensate half of the lost revenues on the gas front. So this is to say that for Russia, oil is indeed the most important item. And as you say, the characteristic here is that oil market is a unique global, let's say, swimming pool. So if Europe puts an embargo on Russian oil, if the US does the same, etc. I mean, yes, we are the main importers of Russia, our Russian oil, but Russia can direct those flows to China and other customers in Asia, for example. And then we will get the oil from Saudi Arabia that will not export that much anymore to China. So everything is really connected there. So it will be very difficult to hit Russia on that unless we manage to convince some countries in the Gulf, starting with Saudi Arabia, to start producing more and more. Should the US unleash some strategic petroleum reserves on the market and convince Saudi Arabia to open the tap, use all the spare capacity they have at their disposal, and flood the global market with oil to lower the price, that could be a very important action that could really hurt the Kremlin a lot.
Right. And of course, this is of course fascinating to understand how Saudi Arabia plays into this. But perhaps one last observation before we conclude is, of course, that one way of reducing the revenues from oil sales is, of course, through the financial system. And that's where the central bank action becomes relevant, because it makes the financial transactions, dollar rubles, more difficult. And it is in that sense that Russia might find it difficult to diversify its oil exports. But I think we have had a fascinating discussion on the various aspects of our foreign affairs piece, which really mostly focuses on domestic vulnerabilities in the European Union and how to ensure unity on sanctions, and less so on the effect of the sanctions on the Russian economy. If you are interested in this piece, go on the foreign affairs page or on our Bruegel website, where we will put up a link. And thank you so much for listening to us. And stay tuned to Bruegel. We will have more podcasts live on various aspects of this crisis unfolding, upcoming in the next few days, literally. Stay safe and healthy. And thank you. Until next time. Bye-bye.